and thanks for turning on the Blender, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's weekly podcast. I'm Bruce Jacobs, a producer at RFERL, and I'll be your host this week. In this episode, what's going on in Minsk courtrooms during the trials of Belarus presidential candidates and opposition rights activists?
None of the witnesses of the prosecution has recognized the persons who have been convicted or the persons who are on trial.
Dark times in Belarus, but in a lighter segment, our correspondents explain it's still possible to laugh. The rabab, as played by a master in Kabul. Two correspondents who recorded him take a closer look at the instrument and its music. But first, Bosnia-Herzegovina is facing its worst crisis since it was established as a state 15 years ago. That's the assessment of Valentin Insko, the international community's representative overseeing the running of the ethnically divided country. Insko reported on the situation to the UN Security Council this week. The recent decision by the president of the Republika Srpska entity, Milorad Dodik, to call for a referendum on the competencies of Bosnia's judicial institutions helped set off the crisis. The move's been criticized by the European Union and prompted Insko to demand the referendum be scrapped. Correspondent Nikola Krastev interviewed the High Representative for Bosnia-Herzegovina, who started off by outlining some of the problems the country's facing.
We don't have a government at state level now for 7 months, and the other crisis is the looming referendum in Republika Srpska, which is a part of Bosnia, but the referendum would be about state competencies. The international community is of the opinion that a part of a country cannot have a referendum about the whole country, about the state competencies, like state court, like state prosecutor's office, and this is why the international community has voiced its opinion that it would never support such a referendum.
Dodik actually claims that his intentions are misunderstood, that actually what he wants to do, I mean, is not what he's being criticized, and he particularly mentions you.
I think if you put together a puzzle, yeah, and if you are putting together evidence what Banja Luka is doing, then the direction is very clear, you know.
Still, do you think that he has, like, at least, like, partly some reason not to believe that Serbs can get a fair trial by Muslim judges?
I must tell you, the state prosecutor, for example, of Bosnia-Herzegovina, he's a Serb, and we have also an independent institution, like, say, BBC Council, for radio. We have an independent institution for the judiciary, which is called High Prosecutorial and Judicial Council, and there also the chairman is also a Serb, yeah. So I think these people are working fairly, professionally, they are not biased, and of course it is also in our private lives, you know, if a judge tells you that you have lost a case, you don't like the judge, yeah. But so far, I think they have been very even-handed.
Do you think at this point there is a possibility for some kind of an armed conflict within Bosnia?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. But of course, some people are speaking about a peaceful dissolution of Bosnia-Herzegovina. This, I think, is a wishful thinking. A dissolution, first of all, will not take place. Secondly, if it would take place, it would not be so peaceful, yeah. But thirdly, most important, if a peaceful dissolution was possible, they could have done it in 91-92 or in Dayton in 95. But the international community and also the neighboring countries, yeah, the neighboring countries, Serbia and Croatia, were of the opinion Bosnia must exist in its traditional borders, which did not change for the last 200 years.
Do you think at this point, when actually the attitudes are quite confrontational and, you know, animosity, or you can call it anyway, is there any way, I mean, to line up the political leaders in Bosnia and Herzegovina so they will find some mutual solution to foreign state institutions?
This would be the best. And even when I spoke earlier that I would use my bond powers to suspend the conclusions of Republika Srpska, it is not my first choice. It's only my second choice. The first choice would be if the government in Republika Srpska and the parliament in Republika Srpska would do it on their own, yeah. Not that I do it for them. As far as the government is concerned, we have the same philosophy. We would prefer if the local actors, the three constituent people, would form a government on their own without international interference.
But it seems at this point that Dodik does not actually have much support from Belgrade toward his intentions. So who actually supports him?
Belgrade has always been very fair and even-handed. They always supported the integrity of Bosnia-Herzegovina, the territorial sovereignty of Bosnia-Herzegovina. Of course, keeping in mind their own territorial integrity, there is a logic behind it. And this time I have got messages from quite a few Serb politicians, from Serb citizens, from Banja Luka, that Republika Srpska National Assembly went too far with this issue, with this referendum on state issues, yeah. But of course nobody is questioning the right of Republika Srpska to have referenda like in Switzerland. They have it almost every month, you know. But it must be about their own competences. Yeah.
During your job, I mean, have you ever had an instance when you have been threatened by somebody or even indirectly implied that, I mean, you shouldn't be there? Or?
Well, politically, yes, but otherwise not. Yeah. There are quite a few people who don't wish this Office of the High Representative to be in existence. And I'm also in favor of medium-term and long-term closure of the office, yeah. But of course, the country must function more or less, not 120%, but the country must function first. And my ideal is that Bosnian politicians and Bosnia can solve in future all the problems in an institutionalized way on their own, yeah, without foreign interference. This would be the best.
Do you occasionally meet face-to-face with Dodik?
No, I met him on Thursday, yeah, last
Thursday.
Week. We know each other for 12 years, yeah. He was a great enemy of Milosevic, enemy of Karadzic. He was, in a way, a dissident, you know. And 12 years ago, or say, yeah, about 12 years ago, he was a darling of the international community because he was a model of a new politician for the Serb nation, yeah.
So how would you describe, I mean, his political evolution during these 12 years?
I think it is a evolution which happened in a way in some other European countries as well, including my own country, Austria, that there are some politicians who are using increasingly more and more nationalist vocabulary, and they are getting support for this by their own voters, yeah. This is an unfortunate trend, but we have seen it in the Netherlands, we have seen it in my own country, as I said, and also in Finland, where we speak now about the true Finns, you know. Mm-hmm. So this is a, we had it in Italy before, but this is also maybe something what Dodik likes quite a lot, you know, to use this nationalistic rhetoric, sometimes even hate speech. Of which I'm very disappointed personally, because nobody, believe me, nobody in the international community, including myself, nobody is threatening the existence of Republika Srpska. Nobody. Yeah. Bosnia is built up in such a way that it has two entities, and the international community has, in a way, a formula, you know, that we would like to see two strong entities in a strong state.
That was correspondent Nikola Krastev's interview with Valentin Insko, the High Representative for Bosnia-Herzegovina. Three Russian human rights observers attending the trials of opposition activists in Belarus were expelled from the country this week. Their office was raided and they were told their presence was either forbidden or unwanted. The observers had been monitoring the trials of political opposition figures who took part in mass street protests on December 19th against the re-election of President Alexander Lukashenko. A number of those on trial are former presidential candidates who ran in the election. RFERL's Belarusian service broadcaster Alexei Znatkevich has been following the trials. Now, there have been some strange scenes in the courtroom so far by some of those attending the trials. What can you tell me about that?
Well, the trials are strange in the fact that so far, none of the witnesses of the prosecution has recognized the persons who have been convicted or the persons who are on trial. So, in general, the witnesses for the prosecution are those special forces, riot police, and what they are saying is basically some participants in the demonstration were breaking glass, some participants in the demonstration were attacking us, some participants in the demonstration were beating us, but none of them so far recognized any of the defendants in the cases, and some of the people have already been sentenced to 3 to 4 years imprisonment without them being recognized by a single witness, just for being there. And some of them were in the videos, they were like hitting the wooden panels that were in the doors of the House of Government. But there were no videos or no things like them beating, attacking the police, none of that.
Now, there's some spectators in the courtroom which are rather small. There's been some strange behavior in the courtroom. What can you tell me about that?
Well, there are some activists of the pro-governmental youth organization called Belarusian Republican Union of Youth, and they basically come there and they just sit. They are taking the place because there's not a lot of space in these courtrooms. They are small, 50 to 70 people can come in. And those people who want to support the defendants and even their relatives, for example, their mothers or brothers, sometimes don't have enough space, not enough seats to go and be present at the trials because some of the seats are already taken by those youths who are just ignoring the proceedings.
They
just
some of them are pretending to be asleep during the proceedings. What's the point of that?
Well, they just don't want the public expression of support. They don't want people to come there and see what's going on and express support to those people, including the former presidential candidates, because we already have 3 former presidential candidates on trial.
And what about the judges and prosecutors? How is have they been professional in the proceeding? Have they shown bias?
Well, our reporters are saying that it depended on some of the trials, judges, they do allow for some motions of the defense. They do allow witnesses of the defense to testify and present evidence. But one of the things that is common that none of these witnesses of the defense is admitted as something that improves the fate of the defendants. So the sentences, even after the judge supposedly takes the witnesses of the defense who are saying that these people did not do anything, after that these people are sentenced to 3 to 4 years.
Did you notice anything from the reports about the different various trials, something that just seems out of the ordinary about them, aside from the things you've mentioned?
Some of the things that may seem out of the ordinary for the Westerner, for example, but they are not out of the ordinary for our reporters who go to these trials regularly. For example, people who are defendants in the trials, they are not allowed to eat for the whole day. Like they come to the trial at 8 a.m. and they sit in the trial. There's a break for people in the court to eat, but these people are not provided food. And sometimes these proceedings take long after 6 p.m. So when these people are brought back to prison, they are not allowed to eat either. So basically all these people have is some kind of breakfast in the prison before they are taken to court. And then they have to spend 8 to 9 hours without food. And there's no much ventilation in the courtroom.
Now, one of the presidential candidates, Uladzimir Nyeklayo, was beaten unconscious during the protests and taken from his hospital bed by men in plain clothes the next day. But he's told reporters now he doesn't think Lukashenko was behind the provocative violence surrounding the election, that there was some third force, according to him, involved. What do you think about that statement?
Well, what he's saying is basically it wasn't in Lukashenko's interests to do anything like that, because if Lukashenko had not used such brutal force, he would probably be recognized by the European Union. He would get some European money and contacts.
But do you see it that way? Is that a naive point of view?
there is some logic in what he's saying, but first of all, we should take into account that Russia probably is still more likely to influence things in Belarus than Europe. And the other thing, you can never judge Alexander Lukashenko by totally rational standards.
Belarusian service broadcaster Alexei Znatkevich, thanks for joining me.
28 languages, 21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
Now, you might think that the political repression in Belarus is no laughing matter, and you'd be wrong. Political humor and satire often act as social safety valves that help people get through the most difficult times. Members of our Belarus service sat down for a session of coffee and some of the political jokes making the rounds.
Слоганом, лозунгом передвиборчої програми Олександра Лукашенка у 2006 році були слова «За Білорусь». For Belarus.
During the pre-election campaign, there were posters for President Alexander Lukashenko with the slogan "For Belarus." So a bus is driving down a dark road at night. All the passengers are tired after work. All of a sudden, some police officers get on and begin beating the people on the bus. The people say, "My God, what for?" "For Belarus."
За що? За Білорусь.
What will a Belarusian policeman do if he is ordered to catch a rabbit? Do you know? The answer is he will catch 10 rabbits and then he will release 9 of them.
Are there a lot of jokes about policemen?
I think so. But there are also a lot of jokes about rabbits, so you will hear another one, I guess.
Звери бегут з лесу, у паніці.
Animals are running out of the forest. They are in panic. Someone asks them, "What's going on? What's the matter?" Some animals say, "The king of the beasts, the lion, is tearing off everyone's fifth leg." "So what's the problem? You've only got 4 legs." "He tears first, and then he counts."
That's very Belarusian. Лукашенко веде перемовы у Кремлі з Медведєвим, раптом йому на мобільник телефонний дзвінок.
Lukashenko has a meeting at the Kremlin with Dmitry Medvedev. Suddenly, Lukashenko's mobile phone rings. He says, "Just a moment, Dmitry Anatolievich." He answers the phone, listens for a minute, and then begins to speak.
Доброе. Доброе.
Good. Good. Bad. Good. Bad. This goes on for 10 minutes. Medvedev has no idea what's going on. Finally, Lukashenko finishes his conversation and hangs up the phone. "See how much the people of Belarus depend on me? They can't even sort potatoes when I'm gone."
What do you say?
Well, Belarusians laugh at. Probably at themselves, most of all. I think Belarusians have many self-critical jokes. The stereotype of the national character is that the Belarusians are very... like quiet, that the Belarusians are very, I would say, silent people, not really energetic. This classical explanation how different nations react to a nail in their seat, like when Ukrainian, when the Russian gets a nail into his seat, he just takes the nail and throws it away. Then the Ukrainian comes, takes the nail and looks and decides, "Okay, it's a good nail, I'll use it later." And then Belarusian sits and, "Oh, there's a nail. Maybe it should be this way."
Звонив мне коллега с Мюнхена.
A colleague of mine called from Munich and read a joke of the internet. Someone in Sweden invents a potion of eternal life. Newspapers report that people all over the world are celebrating, except in Belarus. There everyone says, "Oh my God, what a nightmare."
Ах ты, Боже мой, нам конец.
That was members of RFERL's Belarus service lightening the mood with a little dark humor. This segment is part of our Inside Joke series, produced by Margot Buff and Daisy Sindelar. To see a video of our Belarusian colleagues swapping jokes, as well as jokes from Georgia, Tajikistan, and other countries, visit the multimedia section on our website at rfrl.org.
You're listening to The Blender, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's new weekly podcast.
This week on our segment, A Different Beat, Central News correspondent Ron Sinovitz and Radio Free Afghanistan correspondent Mustafa Sarwar explain the exotic sounds of a stringed lute called the rabab. They share field recordings they made of a master playing the instrument in Kabul shortly after the collapse of the Taliban regime, which had banned the music as being un-Islamic.
Welcome to A Different Beat. We're here in the studio today with Mustafa Sarwar, correspondent for Radio Free Europe's Radio Free Afghanistan.
Thank you.
We're talking today about an instrument from Afghanistan called a rabab. We don't have an Afghan rabab master in the studio, but we do have some field recordings to share that Mustafa and I worked on together. The rabab can be described as a kind of Afghan banjo sitar. It has a skin face like the banjo. It is similar to a sitar in that there are three melody strings on the rabab. Also, 13 sympathetic strings, tiny strings that one occasionally could strum, but they are tuned to the notes of the melody that the soloist will play. If the melody will change, then the soloist will change the tuning of some of the sympathetic strings to match the melody. The sympathetic strings light by themselves in a way, even without being touched at all, just from the harmonic vibrations inside the instrument, causing them to vibrate in sympathy with the main melody.
This is the tuning for the sympathetic strings.
Mustafa, if you recall, in early 2002, when I was in Afghanistan reporting, you accompanied me. We stumbled across a shop with a rabab hanging in the window and a man who was a master at rabab inside.
His name was Ghausuddin, and I found that he was, you know, an expert from what he actually played for us. So it attracted us and made us go inside.
He introduced the rabab, showing some basic exercises, the do-re-mi-fa-sol-la-ti-do exercise, or as they would say in Afghanistan, sa-re-ga-ma-pa-da-ni-sa. It's not just about going up and down the scale, but the many variations that one can play, many different ways to play the same scale.
This is some basic exercise for rabab.
It was mesmerizing to listen to him play. What I also found fascinating about that day, it was early 2002. The Taliban regime had literally left Kabul just a few months earlier. Music had been forbidden for 5 years. And here was a man who was transplanting Afghanistan's classical music traditions back in Kabul after a 5-year absence.
Ghausuddin was one of those people who was trying to actually revitalize music instruments like rubab, because during the Taliban, people were deprived of playing or listening to music. It was a nightmare, actually, during the Taliban. But I was really impressed by what was Ghausuddin doing. I remember he played a very popular Afghan song, which is Damode Dada Watan, or This is the Country of Our Ancestors. We are using that every day in our program, so it's a call signal or a sign-on signal. We start our programs every day with this Damode Dada Watan recording.
And that's all we have for this week. I'm Bruce Jacobs. Thanks for turning on the blender from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. To close this week's podcast, here's an extended excerpt of that Kabul Rabab Master's intricate performance.